Judges, the Old Testament, the book of Judges, chapter 12. I should say that I was shocked at the last line of the hymn, because it's not true. Because all men will never see the light. We know that. The Bible makes that plain. But many more might in our own day. Judges chapter 12. We are again involved with the tribe of Ephraim in this short chapter. A fortnight ago, we drew attention to the prominence of the Josephine tribes, the tribes of Joseph in the books of Joshua and Judges. And we referred to the reason for their prominence, namely the prophecies made by Jacob concerning his favored grandsons, the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. The prophecies that he made as an old man in Egypt. According them, the supremacy in Israel. And so I'm going to read with you again the references to that in the book of Genesis. There'll be quite a number of readings this evening. You don't need to turn them up unless you like. I'll read them as intelligently as I can. But if you care to turn them up, we turn now to Genesis chapter 48 and the beginning of the chapter. Genesis 48 and 1. Sometime later, Joseph was told, "Your father is ill." So he took his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. When Jacob was told, "Your son Joseph has come to you," Israel rallied his strength and sat up on the bed. Jacob said to Joseph, his son, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan," Bethel indeed, "and there he blessed me and said to me, 'I am going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of peoples, and I will give this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you.'" Now, move to chapter 49. We'll come back to chapter 48 in a moment. Chapter 49 and verse 22. And this is what Jacob, the aged, dying Jacob, said about Joseph. "Joseph is a fruitful vine near a spring, whose branches climb over a wall. With bitterness archers attacked him. They shot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. His strong arms stayed supple because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because of your father's God who helps you, because of the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of the heavens above, blessings of the deep that lies below, blessings of the breast and womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains, than the bounty of the age-old hills. Let all these rest on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the prince among his brothers." Then back to 48 and 15. "Then Jacob blessed Joseph and said, 'May the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has delivered me from all harm, may he bless these boys. May they be called by my name and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they increase greatly upon the earth. When Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he was displeased, so he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph said to him, "No, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he." Well, that was true of Jacob himself, wasn't it? "And his descendants will become a group of nations." He blessed them that day and said, "In your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh." So he put the younger Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. However, Ephraim's supremacy became, as we are beginning to see in our studies in Judges, Ephraim's supremacy became something of a grievance in Israel. As we saw when they proved so difficult with Gideon, you remember, who was of the fellow Josephian tribe of Manasseh, when the Lord called Gideon to leadership in a day of Israel's trouble. You see that in Judges 8, the first three verses of Judges, if you want to check up on that. It would appear from Ephraim's grievance here with Jephthah in chapter 12 that the tribe was likely to fall away from its supremacy, maybe even in numbers, although it doesn't say that. Perhaps their boast of wanting to fight, when they complained, you remember, to Gideon in chapter 8, verses 1 to 3 that I referred to, perhaps their complaint was in fact bogus. And certainly their intention to fight is questionable. And we certainly see them in distress with the Ammonites, along with Judah and Benjamin, in chapter 10, verse 9. So when Jephthah the Gileadite of the tribe of Manasseh gained that magnificent victory over the Ammonites, the Ephraimites were furious, chapter 12, verse 1, and complained to Jephthah, as they had complained earlier to Gideon, that they had not been asked to the fight, which again may very well have been an excuse, although admittedly the Ephraimites had played their part for Gideon, if you remember, when they manned the River Jordan and captured the Midianite leaders, Oreb and Zeb, and you remember, slew them, and alas, gave their heads to Gideon. That's Judges chapter 7, verses 24 and 25. However, the Ephraimites are now flaming with anger in chapter 12 at Jephthah, because they said they had not been asked to fight against the Ammonites. So they threatened to come and burn down Jephthah's house over his head. But Jephthah denied that they had not been asked. He said they were called but did not come. However, they wouldn't listen to that and were really going to fight this time. But not against, notice, not against Ammonites or Midianites, but they were going to fight against Jephthah and the Gileadites, their brother Israelites. Oh, surely Surely a new sense of inferiority had made them so mad that they were now readier to fight their brother Israelites than they had been in two wars to fight against these heathen peoples of Ammon and Midian. Whether they really would have fought, as they threatened to do, against Jephthah and the Gileadites, they now had no option, for Jephthah was going to fight them. He had had enough of their complaining. And we saw earlier, a fortnight ago, in chapter 11, the statesman-like speech of Jephthah. He was a statesman indeed, as he spoke to the heathen in refuting their claim, you remember, that Israel, coming from Egypt, had seized their Ammonite territory. Oh no, Jephthah had said earlier, you remember. You refused us peaceful passage through your land when we came from Egypt, as Edom and Moab also refused us passage. But you rose up and fought against us. Edom and Moab didn't do that. And the Lord therefore gave us your land. So, Jephthah is equally statesmanlike here. He saw that he was being afflicted by a gurning and carping people on the wane who had a far greater inclination to complain and argue than to fight. And you see this in our chapter, verse 4, where the Ephraimites whine away, "You Gileadites are renegades from Ephraim and Manasseh." So Jephthah and the Gileadites rose up and fought them. And this is virtually, you see, the end of Ephraim's glorious run of good fortune and favor of the Lord, which they enjoyed by the prophecy of their grandfather, Jacob. They obviously began to lack faith and insight, and therefore zeal, and they hadn't the stomach for a fight against the heathen, although they seemed to have some against their brother Israelite, which is appalling. And you see, it is necessary to follow through this decline in Ephraim's fortunes to understand these significant verses in Psalm 78 that we're going to look at later on. And verses which we have before drawn attention to, verses which declare the Lord's rejection of the tribe of Ephraim, as well as rejecting, you remember, for the leadership of Israel, Reuben, Levi, and Benjamin, King Saul, you remember, as the Lord looked for a tribe worthy to produce Messiah, and that tribe turned out to be Judah. But let's look at Psalm 78, and certain verses there. It's a long psalm, Psalm 78 from verse 65. "Then the Lord awoke us from a sleep, as a man wakes from the stupor of wine. He beat back his enemies, he put them to everlasting shame. Then he rejected the tents of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. He built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth that he had established forever. He chose David his servant and took him from the sheep pens, from tending the sheep. He brought him to be the shepherd of his people Jacob, of Israel his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart, with skillful hands. He led them. Isn't that interesting? By the way, we see from the explanation deriving from a close study of these chapters of Judges that so very many of the questions which naturally arise in our minds about apparently dogmatic statements in one part of the Word of God or another, so many of these questions are answered within the Word itself in other places. And it is such labor as this, studying closely the Word of God, as you were saying, the Islamic people do in their religion, and is not as intense in our own land these days as it used to be in the days of the catechism. I say it is such labor as this which helps us preserve our high view of Scripture. Because instead of being ready, like so many smart Alecs and clever Johns, to dismiss the Word here and there, we were talking about Bishop Jenkins this morning, because on the surface there seem to be contradictions or mysteries of some kind, we continue to study the Word with diligence and with the profound respect we owe to the divine revelation, and we find gradually that its secrets and its mysteries open to us. Not by any means all of them. Remember what we were reading from Deuteronomy 29 and 29, that the secret things belong to the Lord. They are not our business. But the things that are revealed belong to us and to our children. No, not all the secrets, but many of the secrets and mysteries are open to us as we study the Word right through from beginning to end. For we cannot know everything down here. But where would faith be, and the divine purpose to train us underlings in faith and trust otherwise than believing and then understanding? That's the order. That's what we were quoting from the thought of the week in the newspaper yesterday. You believe that you may understand, not that you understand that you may believe. If that were so, we would progressively seek to aspire to God's throne as Lucifer did, you see, and criticize the Almighty God and his Word of truth. Lucifer sought to aspire to God's throne, whose downfall was not primarily on account of his inferiority. That was natural, because he was a creature of God. But his downfall was due to the evil of his heart, which accepted the high place God gave him in his permissive generosity, but misused and abused it to generate the pride which caused him to aspire beyond his station in his futile attempts to unseat and usurp the Almighty. So that pride went before the first fall, which led the world into its present sinful mess, from which only Jesus Christ of the tribe of Judah can extricate us. But let's attend to the military situation in this short chapter. The Ephraimites in their anger had crossed the Jordan into Gilead territory to challenge Jephthah. They had been bold enough to do that, and Jephthah, with articulate grace, answered their charge and refuted it, but apparently without effect. So the battle was joined. Note, this is something entirely new and practically unheard of, except concerning Benjamin in chapter 20 of this book. Unheard of, namely, Israel fighting against Israel, and Joseph against Joseph. It would have made poor old Joseph turn in his grave not far, very far away. And Jacob in his grave at Machpelah, at Hebron. And I'm trying to think, and I was trying to think when I wrote this down, of other examples of Israel fighting against Israel. There was Saul, of course, against David, and Absalom's revolt against his father, and doubtless other incidents I haven't been able to recall. But it is a most unusual and grave occurrence, Israel fighting against Israel, like Christian fighting against Christian in the eyes of the world. How terrible! And even today, you see, with regard to Israel, although there are strong political differences between the parties in Israel, is there any nation on earth as solidly bound together as Israel is? Well, you might say they need to be. And of course they do, with as many enemies as they have. But you see, you won't find Israel splitting up into regions, or even separate nations, like so many in the United Kingdom want to do. And although the 10 tribes were long separated from the 2 in faraway Assyria, and then the 2 in Babylon, we have little doubt that they filtered together again. Certainly, Irene Bradley, the Hebrew Christian lady who used to come and speak to us about Messiah and the Jews, knew, she said, that she was of the tribe of Levi. But as to the joining of the tribes together, we'll come to that later on. But back to the battle. Ephraim, having asked for it, and having crossed the river to face it, had to fight. But it was far from too their advantage. The Gileadites struck them down until the Ephraimites were more than ready to flee across the river to their own territory. But the Gileadites manned the river, as we read, as Ephraim, you remember, had done in Gideon's day, chapter 7, verses 24 and 25, to intercept the Ephraimites' return to the west, and alas, to slay them as they approach. It appears that the fords of Jordan at that place was a main crossing place with considerable traffic, and so, as people approached the water seeking to cross over, they were asked, since there may have been attempts, doubtless there were attempts at disguise, since the Ephraimites saw the danger, they were asked, "Are you an Ephraimite?" "No." "Well then, say Shibboleth." And if he said Sibboleth, because he couldn't pronounce S-H. He was killed. 42,000 of them, it says. Well, that's a very large number of men, isn't it? They do say, you know, that the word thousand in the Hebrew can mean clan or family unit, or it can even denote the officers over the military divisions. So Old Testament scholars are careful, even the most conservative scholars are exceedingly careful of large numbers in the Old Testament. They say that there is no really satisfactory key to the understanding of large numbers in the Old Testament. However, whether there were many or few slain, it was an abominable thing for Israelite to slay his brother Israel. Although, in the beginning, the Ephraimites had asked for it. And of course, if any large number was slain, that would seriously diminish their numbers, and Ephraim was almost always the largest tribe of Israel. Look at the beginning of the book of Numbers and the end of book of Numbers, and although the numbers of the tribes vary from the beginning of the book of Numbers to the end of the book of Numbers, Ephraim is a very large tribe at the beginning and the ending. But this, of course, would diminish their numbers very seriously. The first serious battle they had been in during the course of the history of Judges. And so we understand how Psalm 78 makes so very much of the decline of the tribes of Joseph, and especially of Ephraim. And so I'm going to spend a little time reading some of this long psalm, which is very explanatory. Psalm 78. Psalm 78. O my people, hear my teaching. Listen to the words of my mouth. The Lord is speaking. I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things from of old, what we have heard and known, what our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, his power and the wonders he has done. He decreed statutes for Jacob and established the law in Israel, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children, so that the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born, and they in turn would tell their children. Then they would put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands. I think it is perhaps not too much to say that the decline of the Church of Scotland, the establishment of the Church of Scotland in this century, is largely due to the neglect of the catechism. Then they would put their trust in God. Verse 7, and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands. They would not be like their forefathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation in their ignorance, whose hearts were not loyal to God, whose spirits were not faithful to him. The men of Ephraim, though armed with bows, turned back on the day of battle. You see, there was a cowardliness about them. They did not keep God's covenant and refused to live by his law. They forgot what he had done, the wonders he had shown them. He did miracles in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the region of Zoan. He divided the sea, the Red Sea, and led them through. He made the water stand firm like a wall. He guided them with the cloud by day and with light from the fire all night. He split the rocks in the desert and gave them water as abundant as the seas. He brought streams out of a rocky crag and made water flow down like rivers. But they continued to sin against him, rebelling in the desert against the Most High. They willfully put God to the test by demanding the food they craved. They spoke against God, saying, "Can God spread a table in the desert?" When he struck the rock, water gushed out, and streams flowed abundantly. But can he also give food? Can he supply meat for his people in the desert? When the Lord heard them, he was very angry. His fire broke out against Jacob, and his wrath rose against Israel, for they did not believe in God or trust in his deliverance. Yet he gave a command to the skies above and opened the doors of the heavens, and he rained down manna for the people to eat. He gave them the grain of heaven. Men ate the bread of angels. He sent them all the food they could eat. He let loose the east wind from the heavens and led forth the south wind by his power. He rained meat down on them like dust, flying birds like sand on the seashore. He made them come down inside their... Oh, isn't this marvelous? He made them come down inside their camp, all around their tents. Delivery to home, you see. You don't get that these days. They ate till they had more than enough, for he had given them what they craved. But before they turned from the food they craved, even while it was still in their mouth, God's anger rose against them. He put to death the sturdiest among them, cutting down the young men of Israel. What a terrible God he is. In spite of all this, they kept on sinning. In spite of his wonders, they did not believe. So he ended their days in futility and their years in terror. Whenever God slew them, they would seek him. They eagerly turned to him again. They remembered that God was their rock, that God Most High was their Redeemer. But then they would flatter him with their mouths, false religion, lying to him with their tongues. Their hearts were not loyal to him. They were not faithful to his covenant. Yet he was merciful. He forgave their iniquities and did not destroy them. Time after time he restrained his anger and did not stir up his full wrath. He remembered that they were but flesh, a passing breeze that does not return. How often they rebelled against him in the desert and grieved him in the wasteland. Again and again they put God to the test. They vexed the Holy One of Israel. They did not remember his power the day he redeemed them from the oppressor of Egypt, the day he displayed his miraculous signs in Egypt, his wonders in the region of Zoan. Here's the plagues. He turned their rivers to blood. They could not drink from the streams. He sent swarms of flies that devoured them and frogs that devastated them. He gave their crops to the grasshopper, their produce to the locust, the caterpillar. He destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore figs with sleet. He gave over their cattle to the hail, their livestock to thunderbolts of lightning. He unleashed against them his hot anger, his wrath, indignation, and hostility. A band of destroying angels. He prepared a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death, but gave them over to the plague. He struck down all the firstborn of Egypt, the firstfruits of manhood in the tents of Ham. But he brought his people out like a flock. He led them like sheep through the desert. He guided them safely so they were unafraid. But the sea engulfed their enemies. Thus he brought them to the border of his holy land, to the hill country right hand, to the hill country his right hand had taken. He drove out nations before them and allotted their lands to them as an inheritance. He settled the tribes of Israel in their homes. But they put God to the test and rebelled against the Most High. They did not keep his statutes. Like their fathers, they were disloyal and faithless, as unreliable as a faulty bow. They angered him with their high places. They worshipped. They aroused his jealousy with their idols, the Baals. When God heard them, he was very angry. He rejected Israel completely. Now, let me stop a moment to say, of course, this points beyond the single tribe of Ephraim. But inasmuch as Ephraim was amongst the largest tribes, often the largest tribe, I think some of the guilt, perhaps a greater proportion of the guilt for what happened to Israel in the wilderness, lies with them than with the other tribes, right to the end of this long psalm. Now notice, we're in the land now. Verse 60, he abandoned the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent he had set up among them. He sent the ark of his might into captivity to the Philistines, you remember, his splendor into the hands of the enemy. He gave his people over to the sword. He was very angry with his inheritance. Fire consumed their young men, and their maidens had no wedding songs. Their priests were put to the sword, and their widows could not weep. And it was then, when Israel was at its very lowest ebb, as it was later on, when Christ came, then the Lord awoke as from sleep, as a man wakes from the stupor of wine. He beat back his enemies. He put them to everlasting shame. Then he rejected the tents of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim, but he chose the tribe. Remember the different tribes who were in the ascendant in successive order? Reuben, the firstborn, was set aside. Levi, Benjamin, now Joseph, and the lot fell on the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. He built his sanctuary, like the heights in Jerusalem, like the earth that he established forever. He chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheep pens, from tending the sheep. He brought him to be the shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them in Jerusalem with integrity of heart, with skillful hands. He led them. But there's a sequel to the rejection of Joseph and Ephraim, which goes far beyond that, which goes far beyond the glories of David's and Solomon's great kingdom. So we move much further forward in history to close this discourse. Do you remember that after Solomon's death, in a backslidden state, his son Rehoboam proved to be as foolish as his father Solomon had been wise. And Rehoboam behaved so arrogantly that the 10 northern tribes of Israel broke away. You remember? And who should lead them away but an Ephraimite called Jeroboam, who had been banished by Solomon to Egypt. Now, to the end of this discourse, I have some other readings, and I give you them whether you turn them up or not. The first one is in 1 Kings 11. First book of Kings, chapter 11, and reading at verse 26. Here's the later Ephraimite. Also, Jeroboam, son of Nebat, rebelled against the king, King Solomon. He was one of Solomon's officials, an Ephraimite from Zerida, and his mother was a widow named Zeruah. Here is the account of how he rebelled against the king. Solomon had built the supporting terraces and had filled in the gap in the wall of the city of David, his father. Now Jeroboam was a man of standing, and when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the house of Joseph. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing, and he tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe." Actually, two with Benjamin, of course. "I will do this because they have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Moloch, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in my ways, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my statutes and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose and who observed my commands and statutes. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son so that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you and walk in my ways and do what is right in my eyes by keeping my statutes and commands as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever." Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt. So Shishak the king stayed there. read that again. Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shish as the king and stayed there until Solomon's death. Verse 42. Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel for 40 years. Then he rested with his fathers and was buried in the city of David his father. And Rehoboam his son succeeded him as king. Now, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all the Israelites had gone there to make him king. And when Jeroboam son of Nebat heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, "Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you." And Rehoboam answered, "Go away for 3 days and then come back to me." So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. "How would you advise me to answer these people?" he asked. They replied, "If today you will be a servant to this people and serve them." Kings are servants. "And serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants." But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, "What is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, 'Lighten the yoke your father put on us'?" The young men who had grown up with him replied, "Tell these people who have said to you, 'Your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter.' Tell them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions.'" 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam as the king had said, "Come back to me in 3 days." And the king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given by the elders, he followed the advice of the young man and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. When all Israel saw that the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David of the tribe of Judah? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, O David." So the Israelites went home. But as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. King Rehoboam sent out Adoniram, who was in charge of forced labor, but all Israel stoned him to death. King Rehoboam, however, managed to get into his chariot and escape